In the two 15-minute sessions we have each morning over this weekend, I want to look at two psalms, Psalms 9 and 10. Psalm 9 today and Psalm 10 tomorrow. These two psalms, it seems, originally were one. If you look at the introduction at the top of Psalm 9, it says, to the choir master, according to Muthlabin, which apparently was the name of the tune that the psalm was sung to, it's a psalm of David. But there's nothing at all at the beginning of Psalm 10. The reason that we believe Psalms 9 and 10 were originally one is that put together they are in an acrostic form. Now by an acrostic I mean that the first verse or lines or whatever begins with the first letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Then the second group begin with a second letter. The third group begin with a third letter. If you can compare with English, it's as if the first group start with A, the second group start with B, the third group start with C, and so it goes on through to Z. Now, of course, the Hebrew alphabet doesn't have the same number of letters as the English alphabet, and they don't correspond, so don't try to work anything out. Just believe me that that's the way it works. From the beginning of Psalm 9 through to the end of Psalm 10, it follows this acrostic pattern all the way through, from the beginning to the end of the Hebrew alphabet. Well, we're not going to speak any further about that. All I'm going to do now is read through Psalm 9 and then make a few comments. Psalm 9 is largely concerned with rulers of the nation. And then Psalm 10 continues to talk about the rulers, but it has a bit more emphasis on those who are oppressed. So although it is one psalm running right through, I think we can pick out two major themes. So my theme for this morning is a word for the rulers, and for tomorrow, a word for the oppressed. Let's just go through it very quickly, Psalm 9. It seems that it was originally written by David to commemorate some victory that God had given him in battle. And so he starts off with this praise to God. I will give thanks to the Lord with my whole heart. I will tell of all your wondrous deeds. I will be glad and I will exult in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High, because, he goes on in verse 3, of this notable victory that Israel had over its enemies. When my enemies turned back, they stumbled, they perished. But you maintained my just cause, in verse 4. You sat on the throne giving righteous judgment. You, verse 5, were the one who rebuked the nations. You destroyed the wicked. You blotted out their name forever. The enemy has vanished in everlasting ruins. Their cities rooted out, their very memory perished. Great stuff. Now this victory, it illustrates God's perfect justice in upholding what is right. The Lord sits enthroned forever. He has established his throne for judgment. And he judges the world with righteousness. He judges the people with equity. The Lord is a stronghold for the oppressed. And so he's not only going to bring justice to the enemy, but he is also going to show his unfailing love and care for those who trust in him. He's a stronghold in time of trouble, verse 10. Those who know your name put their trust in you, for you, Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. Therefore, the whole congregation is called together to praise him. Verse 11, sing praises to the Lord who dwells in Zion. Tell among the peoples his deeds, for he who avenges blood is mindful of them. He does not forget the cry of the afflicted. Oh, be gracious to me, O Lord. Look at what I suffer from those who hate me. And so now he's recalling the enemy attacks, his desperate prayers, and he promises that he's going to offer public praise to God upon his triumphant return to Jerusalem. You lift up me from the gates of death, so that, verse 14, I may recount all your praises, and in the gates of the daughter of Zion I will rejoice in your deliverance. The nations have sunk in the pit that they have made. He knows God is righteous, and he knows that God is going to punish the wicked, give them their deserts, and at the same time care for the righteous. So these nations are going to sink into the pit. The net that they have spread, their own foot is going to get caught in it. Serves them right, he says. Verse 16, the Lord has made himself known. He has executed judgment. The wicked are snared in the work of their own hands. They shall depart to Sheol, all the nations that forget God. For the needy shall not always be forgotten, and the hope of the poor shall not perish forever. God knows those who are his. Arise, O Lord, let not man prevail. Let the nations be judged before you. Put them in fear, O Lord. Let the nations know that they are but men. They cannot compete with the God of Israel. Well, that's the psalm. And now I have singled out 5 points. Just 5 points that we might reflect on for our own help. And if we're leaders, maybe not national leaders, maybe leaders in families, leaders in business, leaders in professional work, leaders in the church, let's find out a few things about leadership from here. The first thing we notice is that he is humble. And that's why he prays in verse 1. He gives thanks to the Lord. He exalts in the Lord in verse 2. He praises the Lord. So he's not going forth arrogantly saying, I've done this and I'm going to lead this great army to victory and I'm the king of this nation. There's a humility there which is necessary for all of us who are in leadership positions. We must know the difference between our power and God's power. We must know the difference between our honor and glory and God's honor and glory. Too often we're seeking our own honor. We're exercising our own power instead of relying upon the Lord and giving glory to him. The authority belongs to God, not to us. That is the first point that David makes in this psalm. That's a reminder for us, be humble. The second point, gratitude. Be grateful that it is God who enables us to do anything. No matter what it is only God who has enabled it. Only God has given these people the victory, verse 2. I'm going to be glad and exult in you, O God. I'm going to praise your name, O Most High. Verse 4. You were the one who maintained my just cause. You are the one who sits on the throne giving righteous judgment. It is all God. Verse 5. You are the one who has rebuked the nations. And he's so grateful to God, because only God has brought him this victory. Later on in verse 13, he says, what I suffer from those who hate me, but you have lifted me up from the gates of death. Verse 14, and so I'm going to recount all your praises here in Jerusalem. He is grateful that everything that he can rejoice in has only been through the work of God. Military power wasn't what saved him. Political power wasn't what saved him. His own expertise was not what saved him. It was only God. And so he comes back, as you and I should, constantly coming back and giving glory to God, grateful to God that he should use one like me. How he can take people like us and use us is a demonstration of his own grace. Because we all know that within ourselves we are weak, we are not able to fulfill the expectations we have for ourselves, let alone the expectations God might have for us. And yet, God uses us. So that's the second point, grateful to God. The third one, faith and hope. Now we know at the end of Corinthians 13 it says faith, hope and love, and the greatest of these is love, because there were people who were trying to exercise gifts without any love, and Paul was reminding them that love is important. But here the two aspects that David emphasizes are faith and hope. Verse 10, those who know your name put their trust or their faith in you. You do not forsake those who seek you. We cannot live without faith. And too often we get our lives so organized that we organize God out. And there's no room for faith because we have it all under control. Then comes a crisis and we are cast upon God. That's what happened here. Only in you, he says, can we put our trust. Verse 18. The needy shall not always be forgotten, and the hope of the poor shall not perish forever. So there are the two words, faith and hope. By contrast, to forget God is fatal. If we disregard other people, or if we disregard human rights, or if we disregard the dignity of people, it's fatal. Verse 15. These nations, they had no trust in God. They had no hope in God. They pursued their own selfish ends, and they are now going to sink into the pit that they have dug. They're going to get caught in their own trap. Those who trample on other people will eventually be trampled on themselves. What we sow, we will reap. And what is happening here is that these people who are devising evil against the people of God, in the end, they're going to find that they will be caught in their own trap. Verse 17, the wicked shall depart to Sheol. Sheol, of course, is the world of the dead. All those people who forget God, these people that have thought that they can conquer God's people and trample over them and do these wicked things to them, they are going to find that in the end they are the victims. When persecution comes, when difficulties come, when we meet opposition, when we seem to be getting trampled on, our rights being denied us, faith and hope, trust in God with that hope that never gives up. The hope is set in God, and the hope of the poor, verse 18, the hope of the poor shall not perish forever. Take that one with you. The fourth point, God is the judge. If we have faith and hope and our assured belief that God is the judge, we need not despair. We know that ultimately he will have the last word. Verse 4, you will maintain my just cause. You, God, are the one sitting on the throne giving righteous judgment. Vengeance belongs to the Lord. He will repay. We don't take the law into our own hands. We don't take vengeance ourselves. We leave it to the Lord, and he will do his work in his way. Verse 7, the same. The Lord sits enthroned forever. He's established his throne for judgment. Verse 8, he judges the world with righteousness. He judges the people with equity. We must never forget that ultimately God is in control. And while we do not sit idly doing nothing, we do not assume that we are God and that we can take over God's place and start dealing out the sort of justice that is only his prerogative. It is not ours. Of course, we have to fight to defend the poor. We are on the side of those who love righteousness and hate iniquity. But I think you see what I'm saying here. We are not God. And the final point, God is God. Nobody else is God. There is only one God. We are simply humans. What we should be looking for is not power or authority or manipulation. What we should be concerned with is obedience. Not exploiting people, not looking after ourselves to advance our own status or our own cause, but submitting to God. Not arrogant, but worshipful, humble, grateful, living in faith and hope before him. And that's the note on which he finishes this psalm. Arise, O Lord, verse 19, let not men prevail. Put them in fear, O Lord, verse 20, and let these people know that they are but men. And you and I, at the end of the day, we are still only men. We are still only human beings. We are just people. When we have done our duty, said Jesus, that's all we've done. We have merely done our duty. But there is one who is the Lord, and we leave justice and judgment, vengeance, and all of those things with him. God is God. We are but humans. And this psalm is reminding us to keep that before us at all times.